Good morning. Hi. It's a little warm in here. Phil, you want to turn that one? I think I turned one off, but if it gets too cold, get up and just turn it back on again. Well, next week we'll have a Jukai ceremony, which we usually don't do more than about once a year. And what the Jukai ceremony is it's kind of a formal ceremony where members of the Sangha that have been practicing for a couple of years take the formal 16 bodhisattva vows. You know, that we've been chanting them. We chant them periodically, and I hope today we can all do them together. I like to do them periodically as just to remind us of sort of the foundation of our life. And what they'll be taking, Steve and Marta and Bob, who's been practicing since the 60s, actually, to kind of formally take vows. They've put a lot of preparation into it. We've been meeting periodically and kind of going over and discussing in more detail the precepts. And then they worked with Connie, who's our sewing teacher, and with her patience and skill and kindness, meeting almost every Sunday to sew a raksu. So a raksu is kind of a little miniature Buddhist robe. It has little squares in it. You know, the Buddha, it was kind of beautiful. I was at Bodh Gaya a number of years ago, and I was up on this temple looking down, and this Buddhist that I was with said, well, you know, that's what the Buddha did. He saw the rice fields, and he said, that'd be a nice thing. He says, let's just take little scraps of cloth that we collect. Sometimes it actually, traditionally, it was also off of dead bodies, actually, and then wash them and clean them and then sew them together to make the Buddha's robe. And this is sort of a miniature replica of it. And then on the back, usually the teacher will give a name. So I actually give some thought to what would be a good name for a person to kind of relaunch them in some way. So my name is Kanzan Jiru, which means inmost mountain, compassion stream. Often the first set has something to do with kind of a little bit about who you are, some acknowledgement, and then the second one set of two characters often represents maybe some place it would be good to go, some edge of your practice. We should all have some edge in our practice. So I wanted to just spend a few minutes talking in preparation, because next week we'll sit and then we'll set up and then we'll do this ceremony where a few people will come forward, and I've been working on their raksu and the calligraphy, and I'll actually give them their calligraphy and their name. They won't know what their new name is until that moment when I give it to them. But I wanted to just say a few things about vow. That when I reflected on it, it seems that all societies seem to have recognized the importance of some kind of ceremony and some kind of vow. I mean, we see it even, you know, in secular societies where when the president, you know, gives his oath of office, you know, or when I was a lawyer, I'm always kind of moved, you know, when people take to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I mean, when they do that in front of people, it really emphasizes the importance of that. You tend to be more conscious in terms of what your speech is. Is this really right speech? And certainly it doesn't work in many instances, but it does seem to work. Society seems to feel a need for this. And I was fortunate earlier in my life, and I was a Cub Scout, and then a Boy Scout, and then an Explorer. And I can remember actually taking these vows, and I had a teacher once tell me, I'd sort of forgotten about that. He says, well, you know, you could actually get enlightened off the Boy Scout vow. And I still remember my vows. Trustworthy. Now think about this. You could actually be a Boy Scout. I mean, you could be a Bodhisattva, a Boy Scout, right? Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind. The next one can be a little problematic, but it's important. Obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. So if you just say those every single morning, and you really steered your life on it, and I actually found that it did. It made a deep impression on me. It actually helped me through my turbulent adolescence, and gave me some foundation and something to steer on. And so that's actually what deep vows are. So, you know, that's why we have marriage ceremonies. I found my own marriage ceremony to be important. Get a bunch of people together to witness it, and you actually make the statement that you're going to try through difficulties and tribulations, that you're going to stay together and try to help each other. So one way to think about vows in Buddhism, these deep vows we take in Buddhism, and these are probably the most ancient ceremony. Buddha, when he first was enlightened, the people that he actually had been practicing with came, they abandoned him because they thought that he was taking the wrong path. But when they heard him, they said, well, we'd like to actually study with you and learn what you're saying. So he actually had them take some vows. He ordained them right on the spot, you know, had them take the vows. So one way to think about it is, in our meditation practice, we actually begin to study the nature of reality. We begin to see that we're not the solid sense of self-centered person that we are. We're a stream of thoughts and feelings, and as we settle into a deeper level of our concentration, we begin to see the small sense of how we identify ourselves as so limited. And then what do we do with that sense? What do we do with that sense of that expansive feeling that we can experience? You know, this, our heart becomes more tender. How do we lead our lives? And so over the centuries, a set of principles seems to be pretty universal. These principles, you find them, I think, when I think of the Bodhisattva precepts, they're not so different, actually, than the Ten Commandments. How they're applied, I think, the spirit behind them, I think, is different, in the sense that, you know, if you don't follow them, you're going to be damned, you know, or, you know, more of a, not a sense of punitive. In fact, the vows are meant, especially the way they're given in our tradition, is they're given more as a sense of like a koan. So when you say, I vow to use right speech, one of the 16 precepts, or I vow not to take what is not given, or I vow not to misuse intoxicants, it's not meant as some heavy prohibition. It's meant as a koan, like how do you use this to kind of illuminate your life? When you find yourself in situations, how does that particular precept inform your life? So it's not like this black and white thing. And this is a very important way to, how do we approach it? You know, it's used as, not as a fixed code of conduct, you know, but sort of objects of contemplation and clarification. So that's the way that's the spirit in which we use. So the vows do require, you know, discipline and commitment. There's no question about it. And initially, I think, precepts were pretty simple. There were five basic ones. I think Buddha, he said, well, what if we're going to live a life of integrity and honesty, if we're going to try to lead a life to be the most mature, awakened people we can be, what seems to take us away from that? What seems to take us away to try to really penetrate our lives through our meditative practice? What are the things that really seem to upset us the most? And they were pretty basic. So they started with just five, you know, which is, we found that if you hurt people, you know, if you hurt people, that wasn't conducive to a foundation for meditative practice. If you tended to lie, if you tended to steal, you were too, it was a reflection of being too self-centered. You couldn't relax into your practice. Your ethical foundation was too turbulent, you know. And then for monks who took a vow of celibacy, that was kind of, in some ways, the simple path. You know, don't, sexuality is just too complicated. Let's just kind of eliminate it, right? So that's one path, right? But if you were to be a householder and you were to be married, if you were self-centered in your sexual expression, you're more interested in yourself than your partner, you weren't being honest, they realized that that was a way you just couldn't practice if that was the case. And then certainly intoxicants. If your mind wasn't clear, if you didn't have the clarity of mind to really see the nature of reality in your meditative practice, and that. So they started with five. You know, and then human beings, being the way we are, they found all kinds of ways to permeate out into all kinds of other transgressions, right? And so they began to enumerate, and eventually they worked up to about 355. You know, well, you know, it doesn't help if your bed's too soft, or, you know, it doesn't help if you, you know, hang out with money, or it doesn't help if you even touch a woman. So, you know, and then, of course, the downside of that, the precepts practice, was that the more you practice the precepts, then the more spiritual you are. And, of course, that's a huge problem, you know, that can lead us down the path of fundamentalism and, you know, and being just amplifying your super ego and the judging quality of your mind. So that's not what we want to do with the precepts, to do that. So there are a few things, though, about vows. One thing is that vows tend to be a little risky. So when you take, you know, in the traditional marriage ceremony, it said, I plight my troth, I plight my truth. That was one of the traditional phrases. So it means that when you get married, you have to sort of give up just your way of looking at things. You have to be able to entertain that somebody else's truth or what their needs may be as important as yours. And that's part of what marriage is about, is to really take that on as a practice. So it's a little risky. And when you follow a spiritual path, you're going to be presented with things that aren't so familiar. So your job is to work with them a little bit and let them push your edge a little bit. Ultimately, you are the ultimate authority, as we've learned in one of the aphorisms in the Lojong teachings, of the two authorities, you're the primary one. So ultimately, you're the one that has to decide, but you will be challenged, you know, when you take these precepts, that they basically sometimes go against our own self-interest. And, you know, you've experienced that in your own life when you raise children. If you really knew how difficult it was going to be to raise children, you know. But it's really a vow. You take that on. I'm going to be a good parent. And you have to sacrifice your own interest. The same when any serious objective that you've taken in your life, like education, decide you're going to go through college, you have to sacrifice. It takes a fair amount of discipline to do that, and that's true with the precepts, you know. So basically what vowing is trying to do is to open us up to a sense of self-transcendence, you know. And it makes our vows, to make our vows explicit and clear and to say and take them in public in front of other people, is a tremendous help in our spiritual practice. I think actually essential to be able to do that. So I thought what I would do, there's a couple pages in here. This is a book by Norman Fisher, and he started a program for young kids, sort of a rite of passage for kids, adolescents. And in the back, he is talking about the precepts, and we've been using this book when we have studied the precepts, and I just want to read a couple pages because he explains the 16, he does a really nice job of explaining taking refuge in the triple treasures, which often people misunderstand when you say you take refuge in the Buddha. I think that's hard for a lot of people. You think you're taking refuge in something external, this historical figure in the past. And that's a very limited way of looking at that precept. Yeah, so I wanted to just read how he talks about that, and then the next three, which are called the three pure precepts, and then maybe we'll go ahead and chant the precepts. So the triple treasure. The first three of the 16 precepts. So what actually happened is they took these 350 precepts and they just said, this is too cumbersome. So sometime, I don't know where it was, the 9th century China, they reduced them to 16 basic precepts. But basically you could reduce those down to the basic five precepts, and you probably could reduce all five of those precepts down to one precept, which is do no harm. And you could probably reduce that precept down to the first of the refuges, which is just see everybody, the golden rule, just see everybody as an extension of yourself. Take care of yourself and take care of everything and everybody. So the first of the 16 precepts are the triple treasure, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The word refuge means literally to fly back, to return, as a bird flies home to her nest. To take refuge in the triple treasure is to return to our own real nature as conscious human beings who were born with and have never ceased to possess, however much we have forgotten it, open minds and tender hearts. So that's the way to think about taking refuge in the Buddha. We're just coming back to our basic goodness of our open mind and our tender heart. Can we take a vow to come back to that? Returning to Buddha is acknowledging that our inmost nature is the nature of awareness, of awakening. That awareness is the root of our consciousness, and awakening is the birthright of our life. So that's kind of our fundamental goal, you know, our fundamental vow in Buddhism is to actualize that truth. So returning to the Dharma is acknowledging that we have always longed to understand life in accord with our open mind and our tender heart, and that we have always wanted to live lives based on that understanding. Returning to Sangha is acknowledging that we have always been part of the interconnected network of all beings, who cannot be separated from one another any more than water can be separated from sky or from water or sky from sky, and that we want to embrace the fabric of connective fully and be embraced by it, living in concert with all that is. So those are the first three, those are the three basic refuges. I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. If we could fully and completely take refuge in the triple treasures, if these acknowledgments could be entirely incorporated into our understanding and living, then the spiritual path would be complete. And we would simply take our places immediately as mature and awakened human beings. There would be no need to take up the study and practice of the other precepts. We would already be them, and our conduct would naturally flow from our own being. So in some ways in our practice, in some ways in Zen, we don't, that way we don't have 356 precepts. It's like if we can just sit with this sense of openness and expansiveness and awareness, all the precepts flow from that. That's what he's saying. But none of us has fully and completely taken refuge. None of us has completely returned to the fullness of our human potential. The first three precepts are expressions of our intention and our commitment to a way of life and action. They are always, for any of us, a work in progress, a path, a hope, the endless effort we want to make. So that's the difference between a vow and a goal. A goal can be accomplished, but vows are limitless. So when we take the vows at the end, beings are numberless, I vow to say them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. That's what it's acknowledging, that there's no end to our vow. It's endless. So then you move to the next three, the pure precepts. The next three precepts, the pure precepts, are less poetic and less metaphysical than the triple treasures. Coming down from the lofty heights of the purity of the awakened open heart, we practice these precepts to affirm that on the human plane on which we are born and die, there are wholesome and unwholesome actions. That acknowledges that. And wholesome and unwholesome consequences, karmic consequences. There is good and bad, as we would like to say in plain English. The first pure precept commits us to avoiding unwholesome action that would increase suffering. We restrain ourselves from doing or saying, even as much as possible from thinking, things that will cause harm. The second pure precept comes at conduct from the opposite angle. We pledge ourselves not only to practice restraint and neutrality, but beyond this, to discover and do what is wholesome and promotes not a superficial but a lasting happiness. And the third precept considers our motivation for following the first two. It commits us to act to avoid suffering and to promote happiness, unselfish, in order to benefit others and not ourselves. This is not conventional altruism. The triple treasure shows us that when we return to our true nature, the benefit and happiness of others is none other than our own benefit and happiness. So those are the second three pure precepts. And then there's the 10 grave precepts that are more specific, which are what we're actually, you know, more familiar with in terms of the 10 commandments. But the 10 grave precepts can be also reaffirmed in a positive way. Instead of saying don't lie, it can say use right speech, be kind, use kind speech. So they can always be reframed in a positive way. And the final 10 precepts are called the grave precepts, for they are the most gravity-laden and most embrace the weightiness of the relative world. Although the 10 precepts are also light and joyful, just as the ordinary world is light and joyful, when seen with a spiritual eye, they represent the issues we must grapple with as we get down to the real business of manifesting our maturity in the world. The 10 precepts take us beyond the soaring insight of the triple treasures and the good intentions of the pure precepts to what we do and don't do in the daily course of living. So those are the 10. So let's go ahead and we do this periodically. So let's do that. Bill, could you hand me the bell up there? I left it on the counter. If you don't have a chant book, please take one. And could somebody bring me a chant book? I don't have one with me. Thank you. So you know that... Thank you. When we do these... Well, here says Bruce's copy. With an old lecture. So the precepts, you know that when we do our St. Dorothy's retreat, we chant these in the evening. We kind of set our intention for the retreat. And we haven't done it here. I thought it would be helpful to do this, not only because it's the new year, to set the tone for the new year, but also because we'll be doing these again next week, more formally. Okay. Do you all have it on page 10? So the 16 bodhisattva precepts, if you don't have it, just look over somebody's shoulder. Okay. So the way we do it is, I'll say the precept, I take refuge in the Buddha, and then you'll say it with me, you repeat it, I take refuge in the Buddha, and then we'll together also say the second phrase, which is, you know, again, these are, I've seen these rewritten in many different ways. They're not cast in concrete. So you can write your own definition, if you'd like. Not here, out loud, but on your own. Because they're meant as a means of contemplation. Right? The threefold refuge, so these are the first three. And there'll be a little pause before we go on between each one. Okay. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Buddha. This means to take refuge in the unconditioned nature of all beings and in our own capacity for enlightenment. One nice way to do this is in the pause, just read through silently to yourself again that the second italicized. Kind of bring it home. I take refuge in the Dharma.
I take refuge in the Dharma. This is the heart's innermost request, to seek truth and wisdom.
I take refuge in the Sangha.
I take refuge in the Sangha. This is the boundless interconnection of all beings.
The three pure precepts. I vow to refrain from all action that increases suffering.
I vow to refrain from all action that increases suffering. This is the intention to always practice a wise and compassionate restraint.
I vow to perform all action that increases awareness.
I vow to perform all action that increases awareness. This is the intention to actually do what occurs to us that can cultivate true happiness for ourselves and others.
I vow to live for and with all beings.
I vow to live for and with all beings. This is the intention to always try to see things with an unselfish eye.
The 10 clear mind precepts. A follower of the way cultivates and encourages life.
A follower of the way cultivates and encourages life. A follower of the way is someone who lives life with awareness. Such a person does not know any harm.
A follower of the way does not take what is not given.
A follower of the way does not take what is not given. Everything belongs to us and nothing belongs to us. We don't take anything unless it is given as a gift.
A follower of the way remains faithful in relationships. One does not commit sexual misconduct.
A follower of the way remains faithful in relationships. One does not commit sexual misconduct. One cannot remain deeply in relationship without a commitment to honesty and openness.
A follower of the way communicates truth. One does not lie.
A follower of the way communicates truth. One does not lie. Our speech needs to be true and accurate. We create and destroy worlds with our words.
A follower of the way polishes clarity.
A follower of the way polishes clarity. Practice moderation. Intoxication, whether it be substances or doctrines, creates confusion and unhappiness.
A follower of the way creates wisdom from ignorance. One does not criticize others mindlessly.
A follower of the way creates wisdom from ignorance. One does not criticize others mindlessly. We make an effort to be realistic and kind in our speech of others. In this way we can love and be loved.
A follower of the way maintains modesty. One praises others, not themselves.
A follower of the way maintains modesty. One praises others, not themselves. Please let others know frequently how much you love and respect them and why.
A follower of the way shares freely. One is generous.
A follower of the way shares freely, one is generous. Since there is nothing we can possess, we approach the world with open giving hands.
A follower of the way dwells in equanimity. One does not harbor anger or ill will.
A follower of the way dwells in equanimity. One does not harbor anger or ill will. When there is anger, see it as anger. Respect it, but don't keep it close. Try as much as you can to let it go. Try not to let a single day end with ill will between you and one another. Practice forgiveness.
A follower of the way respects the Buddha and all teachers, unfolds the Dharma, and nourishes the Sangha.
A follower of the way respects the Buddha and all teachers, unfolds the Dharma, and nourishes the Sangha. Please respect each other as Buddha, and then the Dharma and the Sangha will be respected and nourished.
Why don't you just take a minute and turn to the person next to you, and or if you know the person next to you and you want to talk to somebody new, and just say something about what comes to you about the precepts. So let's just the exercise. First person will talk for 4 minutes, and then the second person will talk for 4 minutes. And if you don't want to say anything, you can just pass. You don't have to say anything. But just see what comes up for you about a precept that you feel called to bring more into consciousness. See what comes up for you. Just two people. Just pick somebody. And then one person, just go. And just see what comes into your consciousness about one of the precepts. And then I'll ring a bell. And go ahead. If you can't find one person, just three people is fine.